She says, "You're a real son of a bitch. Did you know that? A ruthless, cold-hearted son of a bitch. Did anybody ever tell you that?" "You did," I say, "plenty of times." She says, "I always speak the truth, even when it hurts. You'll never catch me in a lie." She says, "My eyes were opened a long time ago, but by then it was too late. I had my chance, but I let it slide through my fingers. I even thought for a while you'd come back. Why'd I think that anyway? I must have been out of my mind. I could cry my eyes out now, but I wouldn't give you that satisfaction." She says, "You know what? I think if you were on fire right now, if you suddenly burst into flame this minute, I wouldn't throw a bucket of water on you." She laughs at this. Then her face closes down again. She says, "Why in hell are you here? You want to hear some more? I could go on for days. I think I know why you turned up, but I want to hear it from you." When I don't answer, when I just keep sitting there, she goes on. She says, "After that time, when you went away, nothing much mattered after that. Not the kids, not God, not anything. It was like I didn't know what hit me. It was like I had stopped living. My life had been going along, and then it just stopped. It didn't just come to a stop, it screeched to a stop. I thought, if I'm not worth anything to him, well, I'm not worth anything to myself or anybody else either. That was the worst thing I felt. I thought my heart would break. What am I saying? It did break. Of course it broke. It broke just like that. It still broke, if you want to know. And so there you have it in a nutshell. My eggs in one basket," she says. "A tisket, a tasket, all my rotten eggs in one basket." She says, "You found somebody else for yourself, didn't you? It didn't take long. And you're happy now. That's what they say about you anyway. He's happy now. Hey, I read everything you send. You think I don't? Listen, I know your heart, mister. I always did. I knew it back then, and I know it now. I know your heart inside and out, and don't you ever forget it. Your heart is a jungle, a dark forest. It's a garbage pail, if you want to know. Let them talk to me if they want to ask somebody something. I know how you operate. Just let them come around here, and I'll give them an earful. I was there. I served, buddy boy. Then you held me up for display and ridicule in your so-called work. For any Tom or Harry to pity or pass judgment on. Ask me if I cared. Ask me if it embarrassed me. Go ahead. Ask." "No," I say, "I won't ask that. I don't want to get into that," I say. "Damn straight you don't," she says. "And you know why, too." She says, "Honey, no offense, but sometimes I think I could shoot you and watch you kick." She says, "You can't look me in the eyes, can you?" She says, and this is exactly what she says, "You can't even look me in the eyes when I'm talking to you." So, okay, I look her in the eyes. She says, "Right. Okay," she says. "Now we're getting someplace, maybe. That's better. You can tell a lot about the person you're talking to from his eyes. Everybody knows that. But you know something else? There's nobody in this whole world who would tell you this, but I can tell you. I have the right. I earned that right, Sonny. You have yourself confused with somebody else. And that's the pure truth of it. But what do I know?" they'll say in 100 years. They'll say, "Who was she anyway?" She says, "In any case, you sure as hell have me confused with somebody else. Hey, I don't even have the same name anymore. Not the name I was born with, not the name I lived with you with, not even the name I had 2 years ago. What is this? What is this in hell all about anyway? Let me say something. I want to be left alone now. Please. That's not a crime." She says, "Don't you have someplace else you should be? Some plane to catch? Shouldn't you be somewhere far from here at this very minute?" "No," I say. I say it again. "No. No place," I say. "I don't have any place I have to be." And then I do something. I reach over and take the sleeve of her blouse between my thumb and forefinger. That's all. I just touch it that way, and then I just bring my hand back. She doesn't draw away. She doesn't move. Then here's the thing I do next. I get down on my knees, a big guy like me, and I take the hem of her dress. What am I doing on the floor, I wish I could say. But I know it's where I ought to be, and I'm there on my knees holding on to the hem of her dress. She is still for a minute. But in a minute she says, "Hey, it's all right, stupid. You're so dumb sometimes. Get up now. I'm telling you to get up. Listen, it's okay. I'm over it now. It took me a while to get over it. What do you think? Did you think it wouldn't? Then you walk in here and suddenly the whole cruddy business is back. I felt a need to ventilate. But you know, and I know, it's over and done with now. She says, for the longest while, honey, I was inconsolable. Inconsolable, she says. Put that word in your little notebook. I can tell you from experience that's the saddest word in the English language. Anyway, I got over it finally. Time is a gentleman, a wise man said. Or else maybe a worn-out old woman, one or the other anyway. She says, I have a life now. It's a different kind of life than yours, but I guess we don't need to compare. It's my life, and that's the important thing I have to realize as I get older. Don't feel too bad anyway, she says. I mean, it's all right to feel a little bad, maybe. That won't hurt you. That's only to be expected, after all. Even if you can't move yourself to regret. She says, now you have to get up and get out of here. My husband will be along pretty soon for his lunch. How would I explain this kind of thing? It's crazy, but I'm still on my knees holding the hem of her dress. I won't let it go. I'm like a terrier, and it's like I'm stuck to the floor. It's like I can't move. She says, get up now. What is it? You still want something from me. What do you want? Want me to forgive you? Is that why you're doing this? That's it, isn't it? That's the reason you came all this way. The knife thing kind of perked you up, too. I think you'd forgotten about that. But you needed me to remind you. Okay, I'll say something if you'll just go. She says, I forgive you. She says, are you satisfied now? Is that better? Are you happy? He's happy now, she says. But I'm still there, knees to the floor. She says, did you hear what I said? You have to go now. Hey, stupid. Honey, I said I forgive you. And I even reminded you about the knife thing. I can't think what else I can do now. You got it made in the shade, baby. Come on now, you have to get out of here. Get up. That's right. You're still a big guy, aren't you? Here's your hat. Don't forget your hat. You never used to wear a hat. I never in my life saw you in a hat before. She says, listen to me now. Look at me. Listen carefully to what I'm going to tell you. She moves closer. She's about 3 inches from my face. We haven't been this close in a long time. I take these little breaths that she can't hear, and I wait. I think my heart slows way down, I think. She says, you just tell it like you have to, I guess, and forget the rest. Like always. You've been doing that for so long now anyway, it shouldn't be hard for you. She says, there, I've done it. You're free, aren't you? At least you think you are anyway. Free at last. That's a joke, but don't laugh. Anyway, you feel better, don't you? She walks with me down the hall. She says, I can't imagine how I'd explain this if my husband was to walk in this very minute. But who really cares anymore, right? In the final analysis, nobody gives a damn anymore. Besides which, I think everything that can happen that way has already happened. His name is Fred, by the way. He's a decent guy and works hard for his living. He cares for me. So she walks me to the front door, which has been standing open all this while. The door that was letting in light and fresh air this morning, and sounds off the street, all of which we had ignored. I look outside, and Jesus, there's this white moon hanging in the morning sky. I can't think when I've ever seen anything so remarkable. But I'm afraid to comment on it. I am. I don't know what might happen. I might break into tears, even. I might not understand a word I'd say. She says, maybe you'll be back sometime, and maybe you won't. This'll wear off, you know. Pretty soon you'll start feeling bad again. Maybe it'll make a good story, she says. But I don't want to know about it if it does. I say goodbye. She doesn't say anything more. She looks at her hands, and then she puts them into the pockets of her dress. She shakes her head. She goes back inside. And this time she closes the door. I move off down the sidewalk. Some kids are tossing a football at the end of the street. But they aren't my kids, and they aren't her kids either. There are these leaves everywhere, even in the gutters. Piles of leaves wherever I look. They're falling off the limbs as I walk. I can't take a step without putting my shoe into leaves. Somebody ought to make an effort here. Somebody ought to get a rake and take care of this. Menudo. I can't sleep. But when I'm sure my wife Vicky is asleep, I get up and look through our bedroom window across the street at Oliver and Amanda's house. Oliver has been gone for 3 days, but his wife Amanda is awake. She can't sleep either. It's 4 in the morning and there's not a sound outside. No wind, no cars, no moon even. Just Oliver and Amanda's place with the lights on. Leaves heaped up under the front windows. A couple of days ago, when I couldn't sit still, I raked our yard, Vicky's and mine. I gathered all the leaves into bags, tied off the tops, and put the bags alongside the curb. I had an urge then to cross the street and rake over there, but I didn't follow through. It's my fault things are the way they are across the street. I've only slept a few hours since Oliver left. Vicky saw me moping around the house, looking anxious, and decided to put 2 and 2 together. She's on her side of the bed now, scrunched onto about 10 inches of mattress. She got into bed and tried to position herself so she wouldn't accidentally roll into me while she slept. She hasn't moved since she lay down, sobbed, and then dropped into sleep. She's exhausted. I'm exhausted, too. I've taken nearly all of Vicky's pills, but I still can't sleep. I'm keyed up. But maybe if I keep looking, I'll catch a glimpse of Amanda moving around inside her house, or else find her peering from behind a curtain, trying to see what she can see over here. What if I do see her? So what? What then? Vicky says I'm crazy. She said worse things, too, last night. But who could blame her? I told her I had to. But I didn't tell her it was Amanda. When Amanda's name came up, I insisted it wasn't her. Vicky suspects, but I wouldn't name names. I wouldn't say who, even though she kept pressing and then hit me a few times in the head. "What's it matter who?" I said. "You've never met the woman," I lied. "You don't know her." That's when she started hitting me. I feel wired. That's what my painter friend Alfredo used to call it when he talked about friends of his coming down off something. Wired. I'm wired. This thing is nuts. I know it is, but I can't stop thinking about Amanda. Things are so bad just now, I even find myself thinking about my first wife, Molly. I loved Molly, I thought, more than my own life. I keep picturing Amanda in her pink nightgown, the one I like on her so much, along with her pink slippers. And I feel certain she's in the big leather chair right now, under the brass reading lamp. She's smoking cigarettes one after the other. There are 2 ashtrays close at hand, and they're both full. To the left of her chair, next to the lamp, there's an end table stacked with magazines. The usual magazines that nice people read. We're nice people, all of us, to a point. Right this minute, Amanda is, I imagine, paging through a magazine, stopping every so often to look at an illustration or a cartoon. 2 days ago, in the afternoon, Amanda said to me, "I can't read books anymore. Who has the time?" It was the day after Oliver had left, and we were in this little cafe in the industrial part of the city. "Who can concentrate anymore?" she said, stirring her coffee. "Who reads? Do you read?" I shook my head. "Somebody must read, I guess. You see all these books around in store windows, and there are those clubs. Somebody's reading," she said. "Who? I don't know anybody who reads." That's what she said, apropos of nothing. That is, we weren't talking about books. We were talking about our lives. Books had nothing to do with it. "What did Oliver say when you told him?" Then it struck me that what we were saying, the tense, watchful expressions we wore, belonged to the people on afternoon TV programs, that I'd never done more than switch on and then off. Amanda looked down and shook her head, as if she couldn't bear to remember. "You didn't admit who it was you were involved with, did you?" She shook her head again. "You're sure of that?" I waited until she looked up from her coffee. "I didn't mention any names, if that's what you mean." "Did he say where he was going or how long he'd be away?" I said, wishing I didn't have to hear myself. This was my neighbor I was talking about, Oliver Porter, a man I'd helped drive out of his home. "He didn't say where. A hotel. He said I should make my arrangements and be gone. Be gone," he said. It was like biblical the way he said it. Out of his house, out of his life in a week's time. I guess he's coming back then. So we have to decide something real important real soon, honey. You and I have to make up our minds pretty damn quick. It was her turn to look at me now, and I know she was looking for a sign of lifelong commitment. A week, I said. I looked at my coffee, which had gotten cold. A lot had happened in a little while, and we were trying to take it in. I don't know what long-term things, if any, we'd thought about those months as we moved from flirtation to love, and then afternoon assignations. In any case, we were in a serious fix now. Very serious. We'd never expected, not in 100 years, to be hiding out in a cafe in the middle of the afternoon trying to decide matters like this. I raised my eyes, and Amanda began stirring her coffee. She kept stirring it. I touched her hand, and the spoon dropped out of her fingers. She picked it up and began stirring again. We could have been anybody drinking coffee at a table under fluorescent lights in a rundown cafe. Anybody, just about. I took Amanda's hand and held it, and it seemed to make a difference. Vicky's still sleeping on her side when I go downstairs. I plan to heat some milk and drink that. I used to drink whiskey when I couldn't sleep, but I gave it up. Now it's strictly hot milk. In the whiskey days, I'd wake up with this tremendous thirst in the middle of the night. But back then, I was always looking ahead. I kept a bottle of water in the fridge, for instance. I'd be dehydrated, sweating from head to toe when I woke, but I'd wander out to the kitchen and could count on finding that bottle of cold water in the fridge. I'd drink it, all of it, down the hatch, an entire quart of water. Once in a while I'd use a glass, but not often. Suddenly I'd be drunk all over again and weaving around the kitchen. I can't begin to account for it. Sober one minute, drunk the next. The drinking was part of my destiny, according to Molly, anyway. She put a lot of stock in destiny. I feel wild from lack of sleep. I'd give anything just about to be able to go to sleep, and sleep the sleep of an honest man. Why do we have to sleep anyway? And why do we tend to sleep less during some crises and more during others? For instance, that time my dad had his stroke. He woke up after a coma. 7 days and nights in a hospital bed, and calmly said hello to the people in his room. Then his eyes picked me out. "Hello, son," he said. 5 minutes later, he died. Just like that, he died. But during that whole crisis, I never took my clothes off and didn't go to bed. I may have catnapped in a waiting room chair from time to time, but I never went to bed and slept. And then a year or so ago, I found out Vicky was seeing somebody else. Instead of confronting her, I went to bed when I heard about it, and stayed there. I didn't get up for days, a week maybe, I don't know. I mean, I got up to go to the bathroom or else to the kitchen to make a sandwich. I even went out to the living room in my pajamas in the afternoon and tried to read the papers. But I fell asleep sitting up. Then I'd stir, open my eyes, and go back to bed and sleep some more. I couldn't get enough sleep. It passed. We weathered it. Vicky quit her boyfriend, or he quit her, I never found out. I just know she went away from me for a while, and then she came back. But I have the feeling we're not going to weather this business. This thing is different. Oliver has given Amanda that ultimatum. Still, isn't it possible that Oliver himself is awake at this moment and writing a letter to Amanda, urging reconciliation? Even now he might be scribbling away, trying to persuade her that what she's doing to him and their daughter Beth is foolish, disastrous, and finally a tragic thing for the three of them. No, that's insane. I know Oliver. He's relentless, unforgiving. He could slam a croquet ball into the next block, and has. He isn't going to write any such letter. He gave her an ultimatum, right? And that's that. A week. 4 days now. Or is it three? Oliver may be awake, but if he is, he's sitting in a chair in his hotel room with a glass of iced vodka in his hand, his feet on the bed, TV turned on low. He's dressed except for his shoes. He's not wearing shoes. That's the only concession he makes. That and the fact he's loosened his tie. Oliver is relentless. I heat the milk, spoon the skin from the surface, and pour it up. Then I turn off the kitchen light and take the cup into the living room and sit on the sofa where I can look across the street at the lighted windows. But I can hardly sit still. I keep fidgeting, crossing one leg and then the other. I feel like I could throw off sparks or break a window, maybe rearrange all the furniture. The things that go through your mind when you can't sleep. Earlier, thinking about Molly, for a moment I couldn't even remember what you looked like, for Christ's sake. Yet we were together for years, more or less continuously since we were kids. Molly, who said she'd love me forever. The only thing left was the memory of her sitting and weeping at the kitchen table, her shoulders bent forward and her hands covering her face. Forever, she said. But it hadn't worked out that way. Finally, she said it didn't matter. It was of no real concern to her if she and I lived together the rest of our lives or not. Our love existed on a higher plane. That's what she said to Vicky over the phone that time, after Vicky and I had set up housekeeping together. Molly called, got hold of Vicky, and said, "You have your relationship with him, but I'll always have mine. His destiny and mine are linked." My first wife, Molly, she talked like that. Our destinies are linked. She didn't talk like that in the beginning. It was only later, after so much had happened, that she started using words like cosmic and empowerment and so forth. But our destinies are not linked. Not now, anyway, if they ever were. I don't even know where she is now, not for certain. I think I could put my finger on the exact time, the real turning point, when it came undone for Molly. It was after I started seeing Vicky and Molly found out. They called me up one day from the high school where Molly taught and said, "Please, your wife is doing handsprings in front of the school. You'd better get down here." It was after I took her home that I began hearing about higher power and going with the flow, stuff of that sort. Our destiny had been revised. And if I'd been hesitating before, well, I left her then as fast as I could. This woman I'd known all my life. The one who'd been my best friend for years, my intimate, my confidant. I bailed out on her. For one thing, I was scared. Scared. This girl I'd started out with in life. This sweet thing, this gentle soul. She wound up going to fortune tellers, palm readers, crystal ball gazers, looking for answers, trying to figure out what she should do with her life. She quit her job, drew out her teacher's retirement money, and thereafter never made a decision without consulting the I Ching. She began wearing strange clothes, clothes with permanent wrinkles and a lot of burgundy and orange. She even got involved with a group that sat around, I'm not kidding, trying to levitate. When Molly and I were growing up together, she was a part of me, and sure, I was a part of her too. We loved each other. It was our destiny. I believed in it then myself. But now I don't know what to believe in. I'm not complaining, simply stating a fact. I'm down to nothing. And I have to go on like this. No destiny. Just the next thing, meaning whatever you think it does. Compulsion and error, just like everybody else. Amanda? I'd like to believe in her, bless her heart. But she was looking for somebody when she met me. That's the way with people when they get restless. They start up something, knowing that's going to change things for good. I'd like to go out in the front yard and shout something. None of this is worth it. That's what I'd like people to hear. Destiny, Molly said. For all I know, she's still talking about it. All the lights are off over there now, except for that light in the kitchen. I could try calling Amanda on the phone. I could do that and see how far it gets me. What if Vicky heard me dialing or talking on the phone and came downstairs? What if she lifted the receiver upstairs and listened? Besides, there's always the chance Beth might pick up the phone. I don't want to talk to any kids this morning. I don't want to talk to anybody. Actually, I'd talk to Molly if I could, but I can't any longer. She's somebody else now. She isn't Molly anymore. But what can I say? I'm somebody else too. I wish I could be like everybody else in this neighborhood. Your basic, normal, unaccomplished person, and go up to my bedroom and lie down and sleep. It's going to be a big day today, and I'd like to be ready for it. I wish I could sleep and wake up and find everything in my life different. Not necessarily just the big things, like this thing with Amanda, or the past with Molly. but things clearly within my power. Take the situation with my mother. I used to send money every month, but then I started sending her the same amount in twice yearly sums. I gave her money on her birthday, and I gave her money at Christmas. I thought, I won't have to worry about forgetting her birthday, and I won't have to worry about sending her a Christmas present. I won't have to worry, period. It went like clockwork for a long time. Then last year she asked me, it was in between money times, it was in March or maybe April, for a radio. A radio, she said, would make a difference to her. What she wanted was a little clock radio. She could put it in her kitchen and have it out there to listen to while she was fixing something to eat in the evening. And she'd have the clock to look at, too, so she'd know when something was supposed to come out of the oven, or how long it was until one of her programs started. A little clock radio. She hinted around at first. She said, I'd sure like to have a radio, but I can't afford one. I guess I'll have to wait for my birthday. That little radio I had, it fell and broke. I miss a radio.
I miss a radio. That's what she said when we talked on the phone, or else she'd bring it up when she'd write. Finally, what'd I say? I said to her over the phone that I couldn't afford any radios. I said it in a letter, too, so she'd be sure and understand. I can't afford any radios, is what I wrote. I can't do any more, I said, than I'm doing. Those were my very words. But it wasn't true. I could have done more. I just said I couldn't. I could have afforded to buy a radio for her. What would it have cost me? $35? $40 or less, including tax? I could have sent her a radio through the mail. I could have had somebody in the store do it if I didn't want to go to the trouble myself. Or else I could have sent her a $40 check along with a note saying, "This money is for your radio, mother." I could have handled it in any case. $40, are you kidding? But I didn't. I wouldn't part with it. It seemed there was a principle involved. That's what I told myself anyway. There's a principle involved here. Ha. Then what happened? She died. She died. She was walking home from the grocery store back to her apartment, carrying her sack of groceries, and she fell into somebody's bushes and died. I took a flight out there to make the arrangements. She was still at the coroner's, and they had her purse and her groceries behind the desk in the office. I didn't bother to look in the purse they handed me. But what she had from the grocery store was a jar of Metamucil, 2 grapefruits, a carton of cottage cheese, a quart of buttermilk, some potatoes and onions, and a package of ground meat that was beginning to change color. Boy, I cried when I saw those things. I couldn't stop. I didn't think I'd ever quit crying. The woman who worked at the desk was embarrassed and brought me a glass of water. They gave me a bag for my mother's groceries and another bag for her personal effects, her purse and her dentures. Later, I put the dentures in my coat pocket and drove them down in a rental car and gave them to somebody at the funeral home. The light in Amanda's kitchen is still on. It's a bright light that spills out onto all those leaves. Maybe she's like I am, and she's scared. Maybe she left that light burning as a nightlight. Or maybe she's still awake and is at the kitchen table under the light, writing me a letter. Amanda is writing me a letter, and somehow she'll get it into my hands later on when the real day starts. Come to think of it, I've never had a letter from her since we've known each other. All the time we've been involved, 6 months, 8 months, and I've never once seen a scrap of her handwriting. I don't even know if she's literate that way. I think she is. Sure she is. She talks about books, doesn't she? It doesn't matter, of course. Well, a little, I suppose. I love her in any case, right? But I've never written anything to her either. We always talked on the phone or else face to face. Molly? She was the letter writer. She used to write me even after we weren't living together. Vicky would bring her letters in from the box and leave them on the kitchen table without a word. Finally, the letters dwindled away, became more and more infrequent and bizarre. When she did write, the letters gave me a chill. They were full of talk about auras and signs. Occasionally, she reported a voice that was telling her something she ought to do or someplace she should go. And once she told me that no matter what happened, we were still on the same frequency. She always knew exactly what I felt, she said. She beamed in on me, she said, from time to time. Reading those letters of hers, The hair on the back of my neck would tingle. She also had a new word for destiny. Karma. I'm following out my karma, she wrote. Your karma has taken a bad turn. I'd like to go to sleep, but what's the point? People will be getting up soon. Vicky's alarm will go off before much longer. I wish I could go upstairs and get back in bed with my wife, tell her I'm sorry, there's been a mistake, let's forget all this, then go to sleep and wake up with her in my arms. But I've forfeited that right. I'm outside all that now, and I can't get back inside. But say I did that. Say I went upstairs and slid into bed with Vicky, as I'd like to do. She might wake up and say, "You bastard. Don't you dare touch me, son of a bitch." What's she talking about, anyway? I wouldn't touch her. Not in that way, I wouldn't. After I left Molly, after I'd pulled out on her, about 2 months after, then Molly really did it. She had her real collapse then, the one that had been coming on. Her sister saw to it that she got the care she needed. What am I saying? They put her away. They had to, they said. They put my wife away. By then I was living with Vicky and trying not to drink whiskey. I couldn't do anything for Molly. I mean, she was there, I was here, and I couldn't have gotten her out of that place if I'd wanted to. But the fact is I didn't want to. She was in there, they said, because she needed to be in there. Nobody said anything about destiny. Things had gone beyond that. And I didn't even go visit her. Not once. At the time, I didn't think I could stand seeing her in there. But Christ, what was I? A fair-weather friend? We'd been through plenty. But what on earth would I have said to her? I'm sorry about all this, honey. I could have said that, I guess. I intended to write, but I didn't. Not a word. Anyway, when you get right down to it, what could I have said in a letter? How are they treating you, baby? I'm sorry you're where you are, but don't give up. Remember all the good times? Remember when we were happy together? Hey, I'm sorry they've done this to you. I'm sorry it turned out this way. I'm sorry everything is just garbage now. I'm sorry, Molly. I didn't write. I think I was trying to forget about her, to pretend she didn't exist. Molly who? I left my wife and took somebody else's. Vicky. Now I think maybe I've lost Vicky, too. But Vicky won't be going away to any summer camp for the mentally disabled. She's a hard case. She left her former husband, Joe Kraft, and didn't bat an eye. I don't think she ever lost a night's sleep over it. Vicky Kraft Hughes. Amanda Porter. This is where my destiny has brought me. To this street and this neighborhood, messing up the lives of these women. Amanda's kitchen light went off when I wasn't looking. The room that was there is gone now, like the others. Only the porch light is still burning. Amanda must have forgotten it, I guess. Hey, Amanda. Once, when Molly was away in that place and I wasn't in my right mind, let's face it, I was crazy too. One night I was at my friend Alfredo's house, a bunch of us drinking and listening to records. I didn't care any longer what happened to me. Everything, I thought, that could happen had happened. I felt unbalanced. I felt lost. Anyway, there I was at Alfredo's. His paintings of tropical birds and animals hung on every wall in his house. And there were paintings standing around in the rooms, leaning against things. Table legs, say, or his brick-and-board bookcase, as well as being stacked on his back porch. The kitchen served as his studio, and I was sitting at the kitchen table with a drink in front of me. An easel stood off to one side in front of the window that overlooked the alley, and there were crumpled tubes of paint, a palette, and some brushes lying at one end of the table. Alfredo was making himself a drink at the counter a few feet away. I loved the shabby economy of that little room. The stereo music that came from the living room was turned up, filling the house with so much sound the kitchen windows rattled in their frames. Suddenly I began to shake. First my hands began to shake, and then my arms and shoulders, too. My teeth started to chatter. I couldn't hold the glass. "What's going on, man?" Alfredo said when he turned and saw the state I was in. "Hey, what is it? What's going on with you?" I couldn't tell him. What could I say? I thought I was having some kind of an attack. I managed to raise my shoulders and let them drop. Then Alfredo came over, took a chair, and sat down beside me at the kitchen table. He put his big painter's hand on my shoulder. I went on shaking. He could feel me shaking. "What's wrong with you, man? I'm real sorry about everything, man. I know it's real hard right now." Then he said he was going to fix Menudo for me. He said it would be good for what ailed me. "Help your nerves, man," he said. "Calm you right down." He had all the ingredients for Menudo, he said, and he'd been wanting to make some anyway. "You listen to me. Listen to what I say, man. I'm your family now," Alfredo said. It was 2 in the morning. We were drunk. There were these other drunk people in the house, and the stereo was going full blast. But Alfredo went to his fridge and opened it and took some stuff out. He closed the fridge door and looked in his freezer compartment. He found something in a package. Then he looked around in his cupboards. He took a big pan from the cabinet under the sink, and he was ready. Tripe. He started with tripe and about a gallon of water. Then he chopped onions and added them to the water, which had started to boil. He put chorizo sausage in the pot. After that, he dropped peppercorns into the boiling water and sprinkled in some chili powder. Then came the olive oil. He opened a big can of tomato sauce and poured that in. He added cloves of garlic, some slices of white bread, salt, and lemon juice. He opened another can, it was hominy, and poured that in the pot, too. He put it all in, and then he turned the heat down and put a lid on the pot. I watched him. I sat there shaking while Alfredo stood at the stove making menudo, talking. I didn't have any idea what he was saying, and from time to time he'd shake his head or else start whistling to himself. Now and then people drifted into the kitchen for beer. But all the while Alfredo went on very seriously looking after his menudo. He could have been home in Morelia, making menudo for his family on New Year's Day. People hung around in the kitchen for a while joking, but Alfredo didn't joke back when they kidded him about cooking menudo in the middle of the night. Pretty soon they left us alone. Finally, while Alfredo stood at the stove with a spoon in his hand, watching me, I got up slowly from the table. I walked out of the kitchen into the bathroom and then opened another door off the bathroom to the spare room, where I lay down on the bed and fell asleep. When I woke, it was mid-afternoon. The menudo was gone. The pot was in the sink, soaking. Those other people must have eaten it. They must have eaten it and grown calm. Everyone was gone, and the house was quiet. I never saw Alfredo more than once or twice afterward. After that night, our lives took us in separate directions. And those other people who were there, who knows where they went? I'll probably die without ever tasting menudo. But who can say? Is this what it all comes down to, then? A middle-aged man involved with his neighbor's wife, linked to an angry ultimatum? What kind of destiny is that? A week, Oliver said. 3 or 4 days now. A car passes outside with its lights on. The sky is turning gray, and I hear some birds starting up. I decide I can't wait any longer. I can't just sit here doing nothing. That's all there is to it. I can't keep waiting. I've waited and waited, and where's it gotten me? Vicky's alarm will go off soon. Beth will get up and dress for school. Amanda will wake up too. The entire neighborhood. On the back porch, I find some old jeans and a sweatshirt, and I change out of my pajamas. Then I put on my white canvas shoes. Wino shoes, Alfredo would have called them. Alfredo, where are you? I go outside to the garage and find the rake and some lawn bags. By the time I get around to the front of the house with the rake, ready to begin, I feel I don't have a choice in the matter any longer. It's light out. Light enough at any rate for what I have to do. And then, without thinking about it anymore, I start to rake. I rake our yard, every inch of it. It's important it be done right, too. I set the rake right down into the turf and pull hard. It must feel to the grass like it does whenever someone gives your hair a hard jerk. Now and then a car passes in the street and slows, but I don't look up from my work. I know what the people in the cars must be thinking, but they're dead wrong. They don't know the half of it. How could they? I'm happy raking. I finish our yard and put the bag out next to the curb. Then I begin next door on the Baxter's yard. In a few minutes, Mrs. Baxter comes out on her porch wearing her bathrobe. I don't acknowledge her. I'm not embarrassed, and I don't want to appear unfriendly. I just want to keep on with what I'm doing. She doesn't say anything for a while, and then she says, "Good morning, Mr. Hughes. How are you this morning?" I stop what I'm doing and run my arm across my forehead. "I'll be through in a little while," I say. "I hope you don't mind."
"We don't mind," Mrs. Baxter says. "Go right ahead, I guess."
I see Mr. Baxter standing in the doorway behind her. He's already dressed for work in his slacks and sports coat and tie, but he doesn't venture onto the porch. Then Mrs. Baxter turns and looks at Mr. Baxter, who shrugs. "It's okay. I've finished here anyway. There are other yards, more important yards for that matter." I kneel and, taking a grip low down on the rake handle, I pull the last of the leaves into my bag and tie off the top. Then, I can't help it, I just stay there, kneeling on the grass with the rake in my hand. When I look up, I see the Baxters come down the porch steps together and move slowly toward me through the wet, sweet-smelling grass. They stop a few feet away and look at me closely.
"There now," I hear Mrs. Baxter say.
She's still in her robe and slippers. It's nippy out. She holds her robe at the throat.
"You did a real fine job for us, yes you did."
I don't say anything. I don't even say you're welcome. They stand in front of me a while longer, and none of us says anything more. It's as if we've come to an agreement on something. In a minute, they turn around and go back to their house. High over my head, in the branches of the old maple, the place where these leaves come from, birds call out to each other. At least, I think they're calling to each other. Suddenly, a car door slams. Mr. Baxter is in his car in the drive, with the window rolled down. Mrs. Baxter says something to him from the front porch, which causes Mr. Baxter to nod slowly and turn his head in my direction. He sees me kneeling there with the rake, and a look crosses his face. He frowns. In his better moments, Mr. Baxter is a decent, ordinary guy, a guy you wouldn't mistake for anyone special. But he is special. In my book, he is. For one thing, he has a full night's sleep behind him, and he's just embraced his wife before leaving for work. But even before he goes, he's already expected home a set number of hours later. True, in the grander scheme of things, his return will be an event of small moment, but an event nonetheless. Baxter starts his car and races the engine. Then he backs effortlessly out of the drive, brakes, and changes gears. As he passes on the street, he slows and looks briefly in my direction. He lifts his hand off the steering wheel. It could be a salute or a sign of dismissal. It's a sign in any case. And then he looks away toward the city. I get up and raise my hand, too. Not a wave exactly, but close to it. Some other cars drive past. One of the drivers must think he knows me because he gives his horn a friendly little tap. I look both ways and then cross the street. Elephant. I knew it was a mistake to let my brother have the money. I didn't need anybody else owing me. But when he called and said he couldn't make the payment on his house, what could I do? I'd never been inside his house. He lived 1,000 miles away in California. I'd never even seen his house. But I didn't want him to lose it. He cried over the phone and said he was losing everything he'd worked for. He said he'd pay me back. February, he said. Maybe sooner. No later, anyway, than March. He said his income tax refund was on the way. Plus, he said, he had a little investment that would mature in February. He acted secretive about the investment thing, so I didn't press for details. "Trust me on this," he said. "I won't let you down." He'd lost his job last July when the company he worked for, a fiberglass insulation plant, decided to lay off 200 employees. He'd been living on his unemployment since then, but now the unemployment was gone, and his savings were gone too, and he didn't have health insurance any longer. When his job went, the insurance went. His wife, who was 10 years older, was diabetic and needed treatment. He'd had to sell the other car, her car, an old station wagon, and a week ago he'd pawned his TV. He told me he'd hurt his back carrying the TV up and down the street where the pawn shops did business. He went from place to place, he said, trying to get the best offer. Somebody finally gave him $100 for it. This big Sony TV. He told me about the TV, and then about throwing his back out, as if this ought to cinch it with me, unless I had a stone in place of a heart. I've gone belly up, he said, but you can help me pull out of it. How much? I said. 500. I could use more, sure, but who couldn't? He said. But I want to be realistic. I can pay back 500. More than that, I'll tell you the truth, I'm not so sure. Brother, I hate to ask, but you're my last resort. Irma Jean and I are going to be on the street before long. I won't let you down, he said. That's what he said. Those were his exact words. We talked a little more, mostly about our mother and her problems. But to make a long story short, I sent him the money. I had to. I felt I had to at any rate, which amounts to the same thing. I wrote him a letter when I sent the check and said he should pay the money back to our mother, who lived in the same town he lived in and who was poor and greedy. I'd been mailing checks to her every month, rain or shine, for 3 years. But I was thinking that if he paid her the money he owed me, it might take me off the hook there and let me breathe for a while. I wouldn't have to worry on that score for a couple of months anyway. Also, and this is the truth, I thought maybe he'd be more likely to pay her, since they lived right there in the same town, and he saw her from time to time. All I was doing was trying to cover myself some way. The thing is, he might have the best intentions of paying me back, but things happen sometimes. Things get in the way of best intentions, out of sight, out of mind, as they say. But he wouldn't stiff his own mother. Nobody would do that. I spent hours writing letters, trying to make sure everybody knew what could be expected and what was required. I even phoned out there to my mother several times, trying to explain it to her. But she was suspicious over the whole deal. I went through it with her on the phone, step by step, but she was still suspicious. I told her the money that was supposed to come from me on the 1st of March and on the 1st of April would instead come from Billy, who owed the money to me. She'd get her money, and she didn't have to worry. The only difference was that Billy would pay it to her those 2 months instead of me. He'd pay her the money I'd normally be sending to her, but instead of him mailing it to me and then me having to turn around and send it to her, he'd pay it to her directly. On any account, she didn't have to worry. She'd get her money. But for those 2 months, it had come from him, from the money he owed me. My God, I didn't know how much I spent on phone calls. And I wish I had 50 cents for every letter I wrote, telling him what I'd told her and telling her what to expect from him, that sort of thing. But my mother didn't trust Billy. What if he can't come up with it? She said to me over the phone. What then? He's in bad shape, and I'm sorry for him, she said. But son, what I want to know is, what if he isn't able to pay me? What if he can't? Then what? Then I'll pay you myself, I said, just like always. If he doesn't pay you, I'll pay you. But he'll pay you. Don't worry. He says he will, and he will. I don't want to worry, she said. But I worry anyway. I worry about my boys, and after that I worry about myself. I never thought I'd see one of my boys in this shape. I'm just glad your dad isn't alive to see it. In 3 months, my brother gave her $50 of what he owed me and was supposed to pay her. Or maybe it was $75 he gave her. There are conflicting stories. Two conflicting stories, his and hers. But that's all he paid her of the $500. $50 or else $75, according to whose story you want to listen to. I had to make up the rest to her. I had to keep shelling out, same as always. My brother was finished. That's what he told me, that he was finished, when I called to see what was up after my mother had phoned looking for her money. My mother said, I made the mailman go back and check inside his truck to see if your letter might have fallen down behind the seat. Then I went around and asked the neighbors did they get any of my mail by mistake. I'm going crazy with worry about this situation, honey. Then she said, what's a mother supposed to think? Who was looking out for her best interests in this business? She wanted to know that, and she wanted to know when she could expect her money. So that's when I got on the phone to my brother to see if this was just a simple delay or a full-fledged collapse. But according to Billy, he was a goner. He was absolutely done for. He was putting his house on the market immediately. He just hoped he hadn't waited too long to try and move it. And there wasn't anything left inside the house that he could sell. He'd sold off everything except the kitchen table and chairs. I wish I could sell my blood, he said, but who'd buy it? With my luck, I'd probably have an incurable disease. And naturally, the investment thing hadn't worked out. When I asked him about it over the phone, all he said was that it hadn't materialized. His tax refund didn't make it either. The IRS had some kind of lien on his return. When it rains, it pours, he said. I'm sorry, brother. I didn't mean for this to happen. I understand, I said. And I did. But it didn't make it any easier. Anyway, one thing and the other, I didn't get my money from him, and neither did my mother. I had to keep on sending her money every month. I was sore, yes, who wouldn't be? My heart went out to him, and I wished trouble hadn't knocked on his door, but my own back was against the wall now. At least, though, whatever happens to him from here on, he won't come back to me for more money, seeing as how he still owes me. Nobody would do that to you. That's how I figured, anyway. But that's how little I knew. I kept my nose to the grindstone. I got up early every morning and went to work and worked hard all day. When I came home, I plopped into the big chair and just sat there. I was so tired it took me a while to get around to unlacing my shoes. Then I just went on sitting there. I was too tired to even get up and turn on the TV. I was sorry about my brother's troubles, but I had troubles of my own. In addition to my mother, I had several other people on my payroll. I had a former wife I was sending money to every month. I had to do that. I didn't want to, but the court said I had to. And I had a daughter with two kids in Bellingham, and I had to send her something every month. Her kids had to eat, didn't they? She was living with a swine who wouldn't even look for work, a guy who couldn't hold a job if they handed him one. The time or two he did find something, he overslept or his car broke down on the way into work, or else he'd just be let go, no explanation, and that was that. Once, long ago, when I used to think like a man about these things, I threatened to kill that guy. But that's neither here nor there. Besides, I was drinking in those days. In any case, the bastard is still hanging around. My daughter would write these letters and say how they were living on oatmeal, she and her kids. I guess he was starving too, but she knew better than to mention that guy's name in her letters to me. She'd tell me that if I could just carry her until summer, things would pick up for her. Things would turn around for her, she was sure, in the summer. If nothing else worked out, but she was sure it would, she had several irons in the fire. She could always get a job in the fish cannery that was not far from where she lived. She'd wear rubber boots and rubber clothes and gloves and pack salmon into cans. Or else she might sell root beer from a vending stand beside the road to people who lined up in their cars at the border, waiting to get into Canada. People sitting in their cars in the middle of the summer were going to be thirsty, right? They were going to be crying out for cold drinks. Anyway, one thing or the other, whatever line of work she decided on, she'd do fine in the summer. She just had to make it until then, and that's where I came in. My daughter said she knew she had to change her life. She wanted to stand on her own two feet like everyone else. She wanted to quit looking at herself as a victim. I'm not a victim, she said to me over the phone one night. I'm just a young woman with two kids and a son-of-a-bitch bum who lives with me. No different from lots of other women. I'm not afraid of hard work. Just give me a chance. That's all I ask of the world. She said she could do without for herself, but until her break came, until opportunity knocked, it was the kids she worried about. The kids were always asking her when Grandpop was going to visit, she said. Right this minute, they were drawing pictures of the swing sets and swimming pool at the motel I'd stayed in when I'd visited a year ago. But summer was the thing, she said. If she could make it until summer, her troubles would be over. Things would change then. She knew they would. And with a little help from me, she could make it.
I don't know what I'd do without you, Dad.
That's what she said. It nearly broke my heart. Sure, I had to help her. I was glad to be even halfway in a position to help her. I had a job, didn't I? Compared to her and everyone else in my family, I had it made. Compared to the rest, I lived on Easy Street. I sent the money she asked for. I sent money every time she asked. And then I told her I thought it'd be simpler if I just sent a sum of money, not a whole lot, but money, even so, on the first of each month. It would be money she could count on, and it would be her money, no one else's, hers and the kids'. That's what I hoped for, anyway. I wished there was some way I could be sure the bastard who lived with her couldn't get his hands on so much as an orange or a piece of bread that my money bought. But I couldn't. I just had to go ahead and send the money and stop worrying about whether he'd soon be tucking into a plate of my eggs and biscuits. My mother and my daughter and my former wife. That's three people on the payroll right there, not counting my brother. But my son needed money, too. After he graduated from high school, he packed his things, left his mother's house, and went to a college back east. A college in New Hampshire, of all places. Who's ever heard of New Hampshire? But he was the first kid in the family, on either side of the family, to even want to go to college. So everybody thought it was a good idea. I thought so, too, at first. How'd I know it was going to wind up costing me an arm and a leg? He borrowed left and right from the banks to keep himself going. He didn't want to have to work a job and go to school at the same time, that's what he said. And sure, I guess I can understand it. In a way, I can even sympathize. Who likes to work? I don't. But after he'd borrowed everything he could, everything in sight, including enough to finance a junior year in Germany, I had to begin sending him money, and a lot of it. When finally I said I couldn't send any more, he wrote back and said if that was the case, if that was really the way I felt, he was going to deal drugs or else rob a bank. Whatever he had to do to get money to live on. I'd be lucky if he wasn't shot or sent to prison. I wrote back and said I'd changed my mind and I could send him a little more after all. What else could I do? I didn't want his blood on my hands. I didn't want to think of my kid being packed off to prison or something even worse. I had plenty on my conscience as it was. That's four people, right? Not counting my brother, who wasn't a regular yet. I was going crazy with it. I worried night and day. I couldn't sleep over it. I was paying out nearly as much money every month as I was bringing in. You don't have to be a genius or know anything about economics to understand that this state of affairs couldn't keep on. I had to get a loan to keep up my end of things. That was another monthly payment. So I started cutting back. I had to quit eating out, for instance. Since I lived alone, eating out was something I liked to do, but it became a thing of the past. I had to watch myself when it came to thinking about movies. I couldn't buy clothes or get my teeth fixed. The car was falling apart. I needed new shoes, but forget it. Once in a while, I'd get fed up with it and write letters to all of them, threatening to change my name and telling them I was going to quit my job. I'd tell them I was planning a move to Australia. And the thing was, I was serious when I'd say that about Australia, even though I didn't know the first thing about Australia. I just knew it was on the other side of the world, and that's where I wanted to be. But when it came right down to it, none of them really believed I'd go to Australia. They had me, and they knew it. They knew I was desperate. And they were sorry, and they said so. But they counted on it all blowing over before the first of the month when I had to sit down and make out the checks. After one of my letters where I talked about moving to Australia, my mother wrote that she didn't want to be a burden any longer. Just as soon as the swelling went down in her legs, she said, she was going out to look for work. She was 75 years old, but maybe she could go back to waitressing, she said. I wrote her back and told her not to be silly. I said I was glad I could help her, and I was. I was glad I could help. I just needed to win the lottery. My daughter knew Australia was just a way of saying to everybody that I'd had it. She knew I needed a break and something to cheer me up. So she wrote that she was going to leave her kids with somebody and take the cannery job when the season rolled around. She was young and strong, she said. She thought she could work the 12 to 14 hour a day shifts, 7 days a week, no problem. She'd just have to tell herself she could do it, get herself psyched up for it, and her body would listen. She just had to line up the right kind of babysitter. That'd be the big thing. It was going to require a special kind of sitter, seeing as how the hours would be long and the kids would be hyper to begin with. Because of all the popsicles and Tootsie Rolls, M&Ms and the like that they put away every day. It's the stuff kids like to eat, right? Anyway, she thought she could find the right person if she kept looking. But she had to buy the boots and clothes for the work, and that's where I could help. My son wrote that he was sorry for his part in things and thought he and I would both be better off if he ended it once and for all. For one thing, he'd discovered he was allergic to cocaine. It made his eyes stream and affected his breathing, he said. This meant he couldn't test the drugs and the transactions he'd need to make. So before it could even begin, his career as a drug dealer was over. No, he said, better a bullet in the temple and end it all right here. Or maybe hanging. That would save him the trouble of borrowing a gun. And save us the price of bullets. That's actually what he said in his letter, if you can believe it. He enclosed a picture of himself that somebody had taken last summer when he was in a study abroad program in Germany. He was standing under a big tree with thick limbs hanging down a few feet over his head. In the picture, he wasn't smiling. My former wife didn't have anything to say on the matter. She didn't have to. She knew she'd get her money the first of each month, even if it had to come all the way from Sydney. If she didn't get it, she just had to pick up the phone and call her lawyer. This is where things stood when my brother called one Sunday afternoon in early May. I had the windows open, and a nice breeze moved through the house. The radio was playing. The hillside behind the house was in bloom. But I began to sweat when I heard his voice on the line. I hadn't heard from him since the dispute over the 500, so I couldn't believe he was going to try and touch me for more money now. But I began to sweat anyway. He asked how things stood with me, and I launched into the payroll thing and all. I talked about oatmeal, cocaine, fish canneries, suicide, bank jobs, and how I couldn't go to the movies or eat out. I said I had a hole in my shoe. I talked about the payments that went on and on to my former wife. He knew all about this, of course. He knew everything I was telling him. Still, he said he was sorry to hear it. I kept talking. It was his dime. But as he talked, I started thinking, how are you going to pay for this call, Billy? Then it came to me that I was going to pay for it. It was only a matter of minutes or seconds until it was all decided. I looked out the window. The sky was blue, with a few white clouds in it. Some birds clung to a telephone wire. I wiped my face on my sleeve. I didn't know what else I could say. So I suddenly stopped talking and just stared out the window at the mountains and waited. And that's when my brother said, I hate to ask you this, but when he said that, my heart did this sinking thing. And then he went ahead and asked. This time it was 1,000. 1,000! He was worse off than when he'd called that other time. He let me have some details. The bill collectors were at the door. The door, he said, and the windows rattled, the house shook. When they hammered with their fists, blam, 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 he said. There was no place to hide from them. His house was about to be pulled out from under him. Help me, brother, he said. Where was I going to raise $1,000? I took a good grip on the receiver, turned away from the window and said, But you didn't pay me back the last time you borrowed money. What about that? I didn't, he said, acting surprised. I guess I thought I had. I wanted to, anyway. I tried, so help me God. You were supposed to pay that money to Mom, I said, but you didn't. I had to keep giving her money every month, same as always. There's no end to it, Billy. Listen, I take one step forward and I go two steps back. I'm going under. You're all going under and you're pulling me down with you. I paid her some of it, he said. I did pay her a little, just for the record, he said. I paid her something. She said you gave her $50 and that was all. No, he said. I gave her $75. She forgot about the other $25. I was over there one afternoon and I gave her two tens and a five. I gave her some cash and she just forgot about it. Her memory's going. Look, he said. I promise I'll be good for it this time. I swear to God. Add up what I still owe you and add it to this money here I'm trying to borrow and I'll send you a check. We'll exchange checks. Hold on to my check for 2 months. That's all I'm asking. I'll be out of the woods in 2 months' time. Then you'll have your money. July 1st, I promise, no later, and this time I can swear to it. We're in the process of selling this little piece of property that Irma Jean inherited a while back from her uncle. It's as good as sold. The deal has closed. It's just a question now of working out a couple of minor details and signing the papers. Plus, I've got this job lined up. It's definite. I have to drive 50 miles round trip every day, but that's no problem. Hell no. I'd drive 150 if I had to, and be glad to do it. I'm saying you'll have money in the bank in 2 months' time. You'll get your money, all of it, by July 1st, and you can count on it. Billy, I love you, I said, but I've got a load to carry. I'm carrying a very heavy load these days, in case you didn't know. That's why I won't let you down on this, he said. You have my word of honor. You can trust me on this, absolutely. I promise you my check will be good in 2 months, no later. 2 months is all I'm asking for. Brother, I don't know where else to turn. You're my last hope. I did it, sure. To my surprise, I still had some credit with the bank, so I borrowed the money and I sent it to him. Our checks crossed in the mail. I stuck a thumbtack through his check and put it up on the kitchen wall next to the calendar and the picture of my son standing under that tree. And then I waited. I kept waiting. My brother wrote and asked me not to cash the check on the day we'd agreed to. Please wait a little longer, is what he said. Some things had come up. The job he'd been promised had fallen through at the last minute. That was one thing that came up. And that little piece of property belonging to his wife hadn't sold after all. At the last minute, she'd had a change of heart about selling it. It had been in her family for generations. What could he do? It was her land, and she wouldn't listen to reason, he said. My daughter telephoned around this time to say that somebody had broken into her trailer and ripped her off. Everything in the trailer, every stick of furniture was gone when she came home from work after her first night at the cannery. There wasn't even a chair left for her to sit down on. Her bed had been stolen, too. They were going to have to sleep on the floor like gypsies, she said. Where was what's-his-name when this happened? I said. She said he'd been out looking for work earlier in the day. She guessed he was with friends. Actually, she didn't know his whereabouts at the time of the crime, or even right now, for that matter. I hope he's at the bottom of the river, she said. The kids had been with the sitter when the ripoff happened. But anyway, if she could just borrow enough from me to buy some secondhand furniture, she'd pay me back, she said, when she got her first check. If she had some money from me before the end of the week, I could wire it, maybe. She could pick up some essentials. Somebody's violated my space, she said. I feel like I've been raped. My son wrote from New Hampshire that it was essential he go back to Europe. His life hung in the balance, he said. He was graduating at the end of summer session, but he couldn't stand to live in America a day longer after that. This was a materialist society, and he simply couldn't take it anymore. People over here in the U.S. couldn't hold a conversation unless money figured in it some way, and he was sick of it. He wasn't a yuppie, and he didn't want to become a yuppie. That wasn't his thing. He'd get out of my hair, he said, if he could just borrow enough from me this one last time to buy a ticket to Germany. I didn't hear anything from my former wife. I didn't have to. We both knew how things stood there. My mother wrote that she was having to do without support hose and wasn't able to have her hair tinted. She thought this would be the year she could put some money back for the rainy days ahead, but it wasn't working out that way. She could see it wasn't in the cards. How are you? She wanted to know. How's everybody else? I hope you're okay. I put more checks in the mail. Then I held my breath and waited. While I was waiting, I had this dream one night. Two dreams, really. I dreamt them on the same night. In the first dream, my dad was alive once more, and he was giving me a ride on his shoulders. I was this little kid, maybe 5 or 6 years old. Get up here, he said. And he took me by the hands and swung me onto his shoulders. I was high off the ground, but I wasn't afraid. He was holding on to me. We were holding on to each other. Then he began to move down the sidewalk. I brought my hands up from his shoulders and put them around his forehead. Don't muss my hair, he said. You can let go, he said. I've got you. You won't fall. When he said that, I became aware of the strong grip of his hands around my ankles. Then I did let go. I turned loose and held my arms out on either side of me. I kept them out there like that for balance. My dad went on walking while I rode on his shoulders. I pretended he was an elephant. I don't know where we were going. Maybe we were going to the store, or else to the park so he could push me in the swing. I woke up then, got out of bed, and used the bathroom. It was starting to get light out, and it was only an hour or so until I had to get up. I thought about making coffee and getting dressed, but then I decided to go back to bed. I didn't plan to sleep, though. I thought I'd just lie there for a while with my hands behind my neck and watch it turn light out and maybe think about my dad a little, since I hadn't thought about him in a long time. He just wasn't a part of my life any longer, waking or sleeping. Anyway, I got back in bed. But it couldn't have been more than a minute before I fell asleep once more. And when I did, I got into this other dream. My former wife was in it, though she wasn't my former wife in the dream. She was still my wife. My kids were in it, too. They were little, and they were eating potato chips. In my dream, I thought I could smell the potato chips and hear them being eaten. We were on a blanket, and we were close to some water. There was a sense of satisfaction and well-being in the dream. Then, suddenly, I found myself in the company of some other people, people I didn't know. And the next thing that happened was that I was kicking the window out of my son's car and threatening his life, as I did once a long time ago. He was inside the car as my shoe smashed through the glass. That's when my eyes flew open and I woke up. The alarm was going off. I reached over and pushed the switch and lay there for a few minutes more, my heart racing. In the second dream, somebody had offered me some whiskey, and I drank it. Drinking that whiskey was the thing that scared me. That was the worst thing that could have happened. That was rock bottom. Compared to that, everything else was a picnic. I lay there for a minute longer, trying to calm down. Then I got up. I made coffee and sat at the kitchen table in front of the window. I pushed my cup back and forth in little circles on the table and began to think seriously about Australia again. And then, all of a sudden, I could imagine how it must have sounded to my family when I'd threatened them with a move to Australia. They would have been shocked at first, and even a little scared. Then, because they knew me, they'd probably started laughing. Now, thinking about their laughter, I had to laugh too. Ha ha ha. That was exactly the sound I made there at the table. Ha ha ha. As if I'd read somewhere how to laugh. What was it I planned to do in Australia, anyway? The truth was, I wouldn't be going there any more than I'd be going to Timbuktu, the moon, or the North Pole. Hell, I didn't want to go to Australia. But once I understood this, once I understood I wouldn't be going there, or anywhere else for that matter, I began to feel better. I lit another cigarette and poured some more coffee. There wasn't any milk for the coffee, but I didn't care. I could skip having milk in my coffee for a day and it wouldn't kill me. Pretty soon I packed the lunch and filled the thermos and put the thermos in the lunch pail. Then I went outside. It was a fine morning. The sun lay over the mountains behind the town and a flock of birds was moving from one part of the valley to another. I didn't bother to lock the door. I remembered what had happened to my daughter, but decided I didn't have anything worth stealing anyway. There was nothing in the house I couldn't live without. I had the TV, but I was sick of watching TV. They'd be doing me a favor if they broke in and took it off my hands. I felt pretty good, all things considered, and I decided to walk to work. It wasn't all that far, and I had time to spare. I'd save a little gas, sure, but that wasn't the main consideration. It was summer, after all, and before long summer would be over. Summer, I couldn't help thinking, had been the time everybody's luck had been going to change. I started walking alongside the road, and it was then, for some reason, I began to think about my son,